easy. My friends who do activism, especially human rights activism, in parts of the world that are authoritarian, the first thing they tell people is get off of Facebook. Use other services to coordinate your activities, right? Use analog services and technologies, right? Facebook is the worst possible way to stay out of the gaze of the state. It's great for motivating people to get into the street, but don't be surprised if there are a couple guys with crew cuts in the crowd with you.
Steve Abedianathan, we want to thank you for being with us. His new book, Anti-Social Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy, professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. That does it for our show. Also author of The Googleization of Everything. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon.
We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and have an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO.
There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras.
So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate the 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Facing America's Nuclear Legacy will remember the victims of the August 6th and August 9th, 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Speakers will discuss the lasting impacts of decades of nuclear weapons testing, the nuclear weapons situation between the United States and North Korea, the toxic cycle of nuclear weapons production, and more. Again, that's Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani. Boing, boing.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland. Presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics, sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury and the Time of Trump, Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available by phone at 503-228 1353 or online at orsymphony.org.
I've been rust, ain't been working, I've been sitting down. I've been thinking how the rich man tries to run this land. Promise he would help us if we put him into office. How he turned his promises around. How he turned his promises around. Big dictator, speculator, senators and agitators. Tell her what they gonna do when they get in office. See what they can take off of us. Take from me, they take from you. Money man, equip your sister. Banker man.
This is KBOO's Wednesday Talk Radio Show, and I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. And that was Cleve Benali, lead singer of Blackfriars, singing Indian Corn Song, which is written by Woody Guthrie and seems appropriate for today's topic. Today's topic is From Shrinking Bear's Ears, Approving Pipelines and Pocahontas, What Trump Means to Indian Country. And I should note, last night, Blackfriars lead singer Benali, he's a Navajo anarchist and activist, was prevented from flying by TSA last night, returning from New York City, after attending a showing of his film Power Lines. He ended up on TSA's dreaded SSS list. SSS stands for Secondary Security Screening Selection. On Facebook, Lee wrote, "I'm mainly sharing this for a record and to give other folks a heads up." And he recommends that you fight fascism with Islamophobic travel bans and ICE terrorism tearing Indigenous families apart. Fight for freedom of movement for all. And so this morning we're going to be discussing the threat Trump poses to Indian country and what Native Americans have at stake in the midterms. The title of the show is From Shrinking Bear's Ears, Approving Pipelines and Pocahontas, What Trump Means to Indian Country. And so today we have a number of guests, and our first two guests include James Singer, who is he's Navajo, and he's the Democratic nominee for U.S. Congress from Utah, and Marone Benali, who is also Navajo and co-founder of the Utah League of Native American Voters. And are you both on?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. So I included links in the description of the show to some of the things I've written about Trump, particularly about Bear's Ears, which is in Utah, and definitely impacts the Navajo Nation's goals for preserving its history. And I wrote a piece called Trump's Message for Tribes in High Country News, Let Them Eat Yellow Cake. The President's Bear's Ears Decision Has Toxic Implications. In December, and I also wrote about in Yes Magazine in December about Trump using Navajo elders as political props. Would you both like to address the role that Trump is playing in Utah politics for Navajo people today?
Sure. This is Murray Benali. I think one of the things that the role Trump is playing, I mean, it's a huge role. I was talking with some friends about that last night. One of them, I think, is that's the most obvious. It's just that Trump being forefront and impacting midterms just emboldens a lot of people just to say and do things they otherwise wouldn't do. So, for example, it brings out a lot of the hatred, a lot of discrimination. Um, it it normalizes that and people start to bring that out and as if though that is the truth. And so I think part of that, it all brings up a lot of these very racist tropes about land and native use of land. But I think in the end, what it really does is it just plays the larger settler colonial project of just really erasing indigenous claims, cultural claims, political claims, legal claims to land by kind of reifying these racist tropes that kind of Trump just kind of allow that Trump emboldens in the electorate. So I think that's one of those things. I'm sure James has far greater insight than I do.
Probably not. No, I think it's a really great point that Moroni is making. This is James, by the way. And what I'm thinking is kind of where the trajectory goes for the future. Like, I think when we were looking at Standing Rock and Bears Ears, these are two kinds of major points of resistance that were happening at the same time. And I saw the trajectory of our kind of the way that we were processing and defining sovereignty going forward. We were looking at a national monument that was co-managed with the federal government, tribes, by tribes. And we saw, things moving with Standing Rock. I thought, you know what? I think we're moving in a more positive direction, a better plan for the 21st century with Indian relations with the federal government. And what I see with Trump, though, is that we've taken so many decades, steps backwards into how our relationship is going to be. And as Moroni was saying, on the interpersonal level, this has created a lot of that pulling from those racialized and racist tropes. We see that at the county level of government, at the state level of government. And then it enters into the public dialogue so that when we talk about what sovereignty means for tribal members and for tribes, that whole conversation then goes backwards. Everything goes backwards into how things were in the 19th and 20th century. So I see that it's a very dangerous precedent that what the president is taking when it comes to native peoples and public lands.
Yeah, I should give some context to what I'm also a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and I think that a lot of Americans don't realize the size of the Navajo Nation. It's got a population of over 350,000 members, and is about the size of Ireland, right? And extends over three states, including Utah. And Bears Ears is in the southeastern corner of Utah, and that county, which is actually itself about the size of New Jersey, is over 55% Navajo, right? And of course, their vote has been suppressed by the white minority, and that was a ruling in, they were found in violation of the Voting Rights Act, the San Juan County. And James, maybe talk a little bit about what is your impetus to run for Congress?
Part of my impetus to run for Congress is to show that Native peoples aren't just statistics or just the asterisk in some of those studies that we see. I'm a sociologist, I'm a social scientist, and so most of the things that I'm looking at are social issues that are problematized. And when I look at how Natives are portrayed in social science, at the very least, I see that everything there is just a problem, that we are just statistics there. And so my goal as a Native person running for office is to say, what are the best characteristics of my people, of our philosophy, our ways of thinking and knowing and doing, and how do I translate that into a politics that can help the American project of democracy? And so there are these two main ideas in Navajo philosophy, guiding principles of Keh and Hojo, those ideas of relationship, that when I find out what my clans are compared to someone else, and I treat that person with that proper respect, there's this idea of empathy, of mutual and social responsibility, and that will totally give the idea of the relationship with that person for everything that goes forward. So there's that there's that. And then looking at how we then treat the land. If the land is our mother, then there are certain kinds of responsibilities that we have. The other part is looking at Hongzhou, looking at this balance or harmony, and saying, if I were to apply this idea in this context of what we have in the American situation at this point of time, I can look at what I look at as a sociologist and say, look at inequality. Look at how imbalanced that is when it comes to our society, and then look at all the social ills that occur because of that. Every kind of social problem is exacerbated when we have massive amounts of inequality like we do in the United States. And the trajectory that we're showing, which is all about selfishness, is all about greed and self-interest, that will only make things worse in the years to come. So pulling that idea of balance then says that we need to have an economy that cares as much for the bottom 1% of people as we do the top. And when we do that, it totally changes the nature of our society. We see that we are much more empathetic, we are much more likely to engage in trust and cooperation and social responsibility. And I feel like when we combine some of our major problems, really we're at a point where we are fighting for democracy versus plutocracy versus authoritarianism, or those tendencies. The answer, the antidote to all this, can be found in the ways of thinking and doing for indigenous peoples. And so trying to push this to the forefront, showing that our issues as native peoples need to be seen, but also that we have ways in which we can cure ourselves and also the rest of society.
And I know, Marone, that you actually founded the Utah Native Voters. Can you explain what you see your role in why, what the Native vote looks like in Utah, and why you're organizing it?
So I co-founded that with James, actually. So James and I and another person, Colleen O'Neill from Utah State University, we co-founded this organization together. And part of like the Native vote is, one of it is we're trying to I'm working with a number of organizations, not just in Utah, but across kind of the Great Basin area. And the conversations we're having is like the impact that Trump really will have is this agenda in the House. Rob Bishop is the congressman from Utah, and he's the chair of the Natural Resources Committee. And under that is the Native American Policy and Alaska Native Committee, a subcommittee, which basically is the entire agenda for tribal sovereignty. This is where the public lands issue was initially brought up. And so we're looking at that and saying, well, how do we get out the vote to impact just a shift in these congressional seats? And at this point, I mean, we've been a friend, kind of like we've been a friend to the Democrats, and the Democrats sort of been friends to us. And sure, it'll be much better under the Democrats if the Democrats take the House again. At least we know that there won't be outright selling of land as there is right now, or under a democratically controlled House. And so what we're trying to do is, one, let our communities know that Trump does indeed have an impact on the daily lives of our tribal citizens. And what that means is, like, that means roads. It means funding for violence against women, which he is cutting by some 50%. The Violence Against Women Act is up for reappropriation this year, in the next month or so. It means funding for housing. It means funding for schools. For these tribal communities, like in the Navajo Nation and in Utah, and so this is what we're trying to tell them, is like, look, this road that you drive on is impacted by federal funds. And if you don't get out to vote for whomever and get your family to vote, these roads may not be addressed, or you may not get the public safety money that you need to feel safe. There might not be an influx of the funding for tribal police. Will be cut as well, education and scholarships and all these other things that we're trying to tell these people, like, these are the reasons you need to come out to vote. It's not enough for you to just vote in your own tribal elections. You need to also be registered to vote in the state and in the county, because we can impact these things and shift this conversation and put tribes at the center of it, and really just seize our sovereignty and our power back. And I hate to say this, through the voting booth. And so that's kind of what we're working on right now. But it's really hard, one, to get the people convinced to get out to vote. It's easy to convince them to register to vote, but the harder piece is like figuring out strategies to mobilize them to vote. And so that's kind of where we're at right now. And we're facing sort of an uphill battle in the state of Utah to make sure that the ballot boxes is accessible, that people of color and tribes can get and vote in these highly gerrymandered districts in the state of Utah. And so these are the things we're doing. We're just kind of trying to raise awareness and say, look, you do have voting rights. The ACLU's around. There's other organizations like the Native American Rights Fund, who's also working on Native voting rights. So that's kind of what we're doing right now. It's like really trying to illustrate the impact of this Trump regime and this Republican-controlled House, and hoping that they get the big picture.
Yeah, and the real looking at the Voting Rights Act violations in San Juan County, even there are real obstacles. I mean, people live in very remote places. The polling stations are sometimes hours away, right. and there's been active sort of attempts to make sure that they can't get access to the ballot, and many of our elders still speak only Navajo. They don't speak English, and so right. getting bilingual ballots as well.
No, absolutely. And one of the things that we're trying to work with the state of Utah on as well is for them to recognize that those Navajos who live sort of straddling the border between the state of Utah and Arizona, they may physically reside in the state of Utah, but because the post office is so close to the trading post, like literally maybe a mile across the border in the state of Arizona, they have trouble because then they said, oh, you legally reside in Arizona because you get your mail at this post office box.
Yeah.
And so we have issues like that that we're trying to sort out.
So a little bit more history, and I guess I'll drag a sort of long question at James. I know he has to go. Some people don't realize the history of termination, termination and relocation. These were congressional acts to terminate tribes in the 1950s, 60s, and were actually ended by Nixon in 1970 when the federal government decided to pursue a policy of recognizing sovereignty of tribes. And of course, Trump has been very outspoken about changing this dynamic and about even turning tribes into corporations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think this is a part of a general trend that we're seeing with kind of the neoliberal capitalist project of having all sorts of different kinds of businesses or the market society to solve all of society's problems and to go forward in some kind of strange libertarian utopia. And that's just not the way that society actually works. So what we need to be doing is trying to re-embed that market into society to make it so that people have some kind of double movement against that kind of primary movement of the market unfettered and causing all sorts of problems. One thing that I see that tribes, and this is obviously open to debate, some of these initial ideas that I'm having is just like, how do we... If we are citizens of our respective nations, but also citizens of the United States, then there are certain kinds of rights and responsibilities that are for us, that we have. And if we then want to contribute to an American project of democracy, then we need to start decolonizing what that looks like. And some of the things that I thought that we could do, and I wrote a short article about this in Indian Country today, about how we can have set up representation, at least in Congress, and having, you know, maybe 4 to 7 members of Congress representing indigenous nations. So these are people from those that are voted in, that's based on kind of population. Or conversely, if we wanted to do it as we have like Puerto Rico and Guam and some of these other territories in the United States, and Commonwealths, and, you know, one for every nation. And then we'd have like 560 some odd representatives in Congress representing each of these federally recognized tribes. And then looking at how we can take take the Bureau of Indian Affairs out of the Department of the Interior. That's the same department where we have it's managing wildlife, it's managing lands and natural resources. We're people. We are absolutely people. If we want to push the idea that we are sovereign, independent nations, then we need to be pushed. We need to rehouse that into the department of the state, where all the other kinds of government-to-government relationships happen. And these are just some kind of basic things that will get us to rethink how we can be part of this American project of democracy as equals, and not this paternalistic, colonial, white superiority type of thing that we've had for the past 500 years.
And there's a real danger to that, isn't it? I mean, there are precedents for turning tribes into corporations, like we've seen in Alaska, where the Alaska Native corporations, although there was a recent ruling that reasserted that they didn't actually give up their sovereignty in that process. But I mean, sovereignty acts as a huge shield for Native communities against, misuse of power by the most powerful country in the world.
Yeah, it's just another way, another device in which land can be stolen, resources can be stolen, all in the name of progress. And I mean, there is a huge danger in that. Every single thing that we've seen from the Dawes Act, from the different kinds of treaties that have been broken, all of that's been done to erase our people, our history, our narratives, our lands, everything about us. And so what I see Trump doing is just along that same line, just tweaked for the 21st century.
Mm. And would you like to address that, Moroni, especially with the, I mean, particularly, you know, the Native community in Utah is actually a pretty substantial voting bloc, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But we're, one of the things is we're a bit disaggregated, and so one of the things that we're trying to do is make sure that we can vote as a voting bloc, and that's one of the things that the Utah League has been working on. It's a little difficult to kind of get the resources that we need to really just focus on mobilizing, but we have made some substantial strides in the conversation, at least among local politicians, and made those elected officials at the federal level at least aware that the Utah League exists and that we will enter conversations when it's necessary. I know at least the Utah League, with working with James and Colleen, we have had an impact on the rhetoric in political campaigns, where at least right now the Democratic Party and a lot of the candidates at least bring up this idea of tribal sovereignty. They don't throw tribes in with a conversation about public lands. They talk about it as distinct issues, and so we're making some strides around that. And that for us, we see that as a little small moment of resistance and reclaiming our peoplehood with these institutions, and recognizing that tribal citizens do have to engage with state and federal institutions, and it's just not simply working with the tribal councils, because funding, I mean, there's all sorts of political relationships, legal relationships that inherently tie tribes back into like state politics. And those are the other things that we're trying to work with our communities and say, look, you also have to vote for who your state representative will be, because if we don't, we then end up in a situation where we have state representatives who introduce bills in the state of Utah that really expedite the process of exploiting Native land, or that support the idea that tribes don't have jurisdiction. And so I know right now the Ute tribe is in a lawsuit with the state of Utah over jurisdiction over land that Utah claims is land for their education fund, but the Ute tribe, per three or four Supreme Court rulings, are saying no, this land belongs to us. And these are still things that we're working with. And so we try to educate our voters and say, look, you do have to vote for state representatives who will introduce bills at the state level that say that state of Utah must at least recognize and support Supreme Court rulings.
Right.
And I mean, and it shouldn't be that case, but in the end, it really gets down to, at least in my mind, of the last couple of years, that a lot of these legislators and just people in Utah, just in general, have been emboldened, really, just to kind of be a bit more discriminatory, to kind of slowly to reveal their real disposition of their disinclination to help tribes. I know I had conversations where someone had at once said that talking about tribal sovereignty is politically toxic for the state of Utah. And these are elected officials and people campaigning. And so well, voting is important.
Yeah. Well,
that's my bottom line.
Thank you so much. Well, I'd like to thank you both for all the work you're doing there in Utah. And I think now we're going to switch over to, we have a couple of people calling from North Dakota. I think you probably know Mark Trahant from Indian Country Today and Avis Little Eagle from the Teton Times discuss what Trump is doing up there. So, because he's pretty busy everywhere. So thank you both so much. And I would really like to encourage everyone to look up James Singer and his congressional campaign in Utah. You know, he's a Navajo leader who is working on the national scene, and also Moroni Benale, who is working to bring Native votes and make them matter in the state of Utah. Thank you both.
Thank you.
So our next guests are include, like I mentioned, Mark Trahant. He is Shoshone Bannock. He is editor of Indian Country Today. Before that, he was a professor at the University of North Dakota during the takeover at Standing Rock. And so he has a lot of perspectives on what happened there in North Dakota. And also Avis Little Eagle, who is Lakota from Standing Rock as well. She is the publisher of the Teton Times. And I'd like to remind you all that this is KBOO's Wednesday talk radio show, and I think that we've been we have a lot of guests, so I hopefully I'm not sure if the lines are full, but I you can definitely check out some of the work. What's going on, what Trump is doing in Indian Country. And I brought up the issue of termination, and I think that a lot of Americans don't realize the role sovereignty plays for Native nations. As I noticed, the Navajo Nation has the population of Iceland. It's a population of about 350,000 people, and has the land base of Ireland. And it actually has a political status higher than the states, higher than the state of Utah or Arizona or New Mexico, the states that it is you know, supposed to be located within, because states are not sovereign in the way that nations are sovereign. And so this is not something that is something that has to be sort of explained to, particularly to American leadership at every level, and to Americans in general, so that we can protect our rights. And certainly the Navajo Nation is, with the size, is probably the nation in the country that most closely approximates a nation. I mean, it does have the population of Iceland. It's larger than 22 member states in the United Nations. It has a voice, and that voice is being felt in states like Utah, and certainly Trump is directly attacking the issues that are important to the Navajo Nation, like Bears Ears. The support that the Navajo Nation has given to Bears Ears is not just the support of individual Navajos, but of national interests. This is their international policy to protect these sacred sites, and is directly what Trump attacked in his presidency when he went there and reduced the national monument created by Obama in December 2016 by 85%, and leaving those sites open to looting. And opening it up to mining, which is definitely his perspective. And next we're going to switch and looking at North Dakota and what Trump is doing there. As many of you know, one of the first acts he did coming into office in January 2017 was to basically announce that the Dakota Access Pipelines and the Keystone XL Pipelines were now back on. The Obama administration was going to launch an environmental review of the project, and he put a stop to that. And now the Dakota Access Pipeline is running. So what everyone stood for at Standing Rock, all the different indigenous nations that joined the Lakota and Dakota people to fight for their land and the safety of the water, you know, Trump immediately worked to disempower that. So I'd like to introduce my guests. We have Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today, the largest national native newspaper in the country, and Avis Little Eagle, who is publisher of the Teton Times, which is actually serves the community of Standing Rock itself. Hello, you both there?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Morning. Here. Morning. Great. So I'll start with Mark. You've been actually covering this issue. You have a whole hashtag Native Vote, right? And you've been really bringing national media attention to the issue of Native candidates and what's at stake for the Native community in this election, particularly the midterms. Could you talk to that a bit?
Sure. Well, first of all, it's just in the hashtag Native Vote 18, and it really is a record year across the board for candidates from Indian Country. To give you just two examples, one, you have three candidates running for governors of states and five candidates running for lieutenant governors. And in most election cycles, we'd be lucky to have three or five candidates running for all the offices in a state. So that shows you just how many there are. Remarkable group of candidates for Congress, state legislatures, and 2 years ago, probably about 1% of the candidates were women. This time, it's just about half and half. So I think that also is an indication of the record.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. And Avis, you are actually there on Standing Rock. What has been the response to Trump's attacks on what your community stood up for in 2016 against the pipeline?
Jackie,
yes, hi, Avis.
You're aware that our tribe opposed the $3.8 billion pipeline, which began operating last June. Trump signed he signed it, approval for it, like 3 weeks into his administration.
One of his executive, his signing, yeah, go ahead.
Yes. So the tribe here, we're still opposed to it. We still have major concerns about oil spills. There is an oil flaw analysis, I think, that they pretty much flunked. And so we still feel that there is not a mechanism in place to address it if there is a leak. And also things that weren't addressed at the very beginning were the tribe's treaty rights. When in the treaties it says that these lands are set aside for the sole use of the tribe, and also the Army Corps, who was in charge of this whole project, they never ever engaged with the tribe and did meaningful consultation. But you know, on a broader aspect, I look at Trump's administration and see the undoing of a lot of environmental laws that are meant to protect us, and then, you know, like pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. It just seems like with the Bears Ears, he shrunk the size of the Bears Ears National Monument. It just seems like there's a lot of damage being done in a very short amount of time, and I wonder how long it's going to take to put such protections back in place when they already took sometimes in years and years, and he's just really done a lot of damage in a very short time. And it seems to me like we as tribes, we always have to deal with how the history is written. It's never written from our perspective, and it's rewritten you know, to make things that happen seem right. The taking of lands, like what we deal with, the Black Hills, our major land claim, when gold was found there, you know, very soon after that, the Little Bighorn battle happened, and Deadwood, I was just down there last weekend, and Deadwood, the town of Deadwood was established when gold was discovered in Deadwood Gulch, so it was like totally overran, but when I was there, it was days of 76, and I was reading all the historical placards throughout the town, and they were written from a totally non-Indian perspective, you know, about it. It never talked about the theft or anything. It just talked about manifest destiny and people coming to the Black Hills seeking a better life with the gold. And so one of the things I was thinking is, I seen this article, and it, Mark will know that they printed it. Indian Country Today printed it, and it was written by Suzanne Schoen Harjo. Mm-hmm. And she talks in there about sovereignty. If you don't know treaties, you don't know history.
Yeah, and I saw that one. That was a good one.
And she explains that treaties are how the United States established their own sovereignty. If they hadn't written treaties with the tribes, they weren't establishing themselves as a sovereign nation. And so I kind of, you know, like to see people when they correct the historical record. But what I really feel is that this administration just can't get it right. And so
yeah, well, I think they they have a perspective. I mean, it's a you know, one of the things I always try to emphasize is that the treatying process recognizes the sovereignty of our tribes. I mean, when the Senate doesn't ratify treaties with anyone but sovereign nations. So when they ratified the Fort Laramie treaties with the Great Sioux Nation, they were recognizing the sovereignty, but that sovereignty existed before the treating process. And you're right, the Native nations have been signing treaties with other nations before the U.S. Before the U.S. was even formally recognized as a nation, it began, one of the first nations that it signed a treaty with recognizing its sovereignty was a Native nation, you know, which, you know, at one point they needed us to recognize them. And you know, treaties are international law. So the treaty, you know, the Black Hills, which is part of the Fort Laramie Treaty, the unceded treaty land, including the area north of your reservation where the Dakota Access Pipeline ran, all of those areas are still legally under international law, belong to the Great Sioux Nation, are illegally occupied through obviously military force by the U.S. government. I think that the people who live in the Black Hills, or even the folks in North Dakota who, you know, supported the pipeline, don't really grapple with that. And what I felt, what I saw at Standing Rock, was I saw the military occupation of these unceded treaty lands. It was made visible to everyone.
And Jackie, like I said, I really, really fear, you know, the damage that he can do in a short amount of time. I think other tribes are also aware that he also placed a hostile official in charge of Indian gaming, saying, first, Zinke said that the Secretary of the Interior said off-reservation gaming applications had to go through the Department of Interior. Then they put in charge Acting Deputy Secretary Jim Quezon, who was adversarial to tribes. And so when I said I really fear, there's so many things putting hurdles in the tribes needing to put land into trust. There are additional roadblocks put in place, and so there's a lot of damage you can do in a very short while. Mm-hmm. And so I also hope, on the flip side, you know, never be so down and out about what he's doing, but maybe there's some kind of hope in all this, that people will get educated, that people are gonna, like Mark said, rise up. And how do we do it? We do it with our electoral system, that people will come back, and that there will be a full swing in the opposite direction, that maybe we can still get on board and protecting our environment, protecting our sacred sites, protecting our treaty rights.
Exactly. Mark, I would like you to discuss a bit about the role the media is playing in the midterm elections, and what you saw as far as media coverage of Standing Rock in North Dakota when you were there.
Oh, two big questions.
Yes, they are.
Start with the election.
this year is really interesting because I've been writing about Native candidates as a group for 8 years now, and this is the first time that the mainstream media has really picked up on the story. In fact, early on, the New York Times did a story on Native women running for office, and it was kind of cool as a wonk because they used my spreadsheet.
Definitely check out Trahant. I just want to put a plug. Definitely check out his blog, Trahant Reports, that he's been running for several years. It has an amazing amount of data on the Native vote and Native candidates. Go ahead, sorry.
Thank you. And National Public Radio did, The Guardian did. I mean, in fact, I just have calls this week from CBC and ABC, both doing stories. So the larger media has really picked up on this, that this is a trend and it's significant, and that's cool. You think about since 1789, this country has never been able to elect a Native woman to the Congress, and here we're going to do it this time. And maybe not just one, but there's still a chance that three could get elected to Congress, and that is really extraordinary.
Wow.
The other question...
Media coverage, yeah.
Standing Rock... was so complicated. It was the first major story where social media was more important than mainstream media. Early on, there was a lot of where is the media, and it was almost irrelevant because people were turning to Facebook Live and getting 100,000, 200,000 people watching it in real time. The international media was on the story very early. And I was just in Germany a couple of weeks ago, and everywhere I've been in the world, people have asked about Standing Rock. It very much was an international story that the media did cover in that regard. But the American media was kind of slow to the party.
Mm. And do you feel locally, I mean, you were a professor there in North Dakota of journalism, right? I mean, how did you feel about the local coverage? Do you think it... I know that with the federal trials that happened with water protectors, they did jury pool, surveys, testing, and they found that the local people in North Dakota are so against the Native people who stood up at Standing Rock that there was no hope for fair trials.
Right, and that started, though, before the events at Standing Rock. I mean, that attitude, I was not prepared for how much... real racism there was in North Dakota compared to other states. And it's interesting to me because even though I'm from Idaho, I spent a lot of time in Montana, and the difference between Montana and North Dakota is really huge. And you really saw that play out with how the story was covered. Now, the newspapers were interesting because they were so decimated, they just didn't have anybody to go cover it. And sometimes when they did, particularly Bismarck, if they were there, they didn't do a terrible job, but they just didn't have the resources to get there. There were days when there were really big stories going on when there was nobody in the newsroom. I think that was a big factor. The other one is the crazy talk radio defined so much of the story. Both in Fargo and Bismarck, folks whose job it is to rile people up were telling what happened rather than folks who are dispassionate saying on the ground. I also think there was kind of a twist on the whole thing because of the way law enforcement went directly to the media and basically told their version of events that were just flat out lies and weren't called on it by the media like they normally would.
And now we have a leader, Trump, who seems to be more like a talk radio show host. I mean, and feeding
Jerry
the public.
Jerry Springer.
Yeah, and really, you know, kind of, I think if you heard earlier, Moroni Benali was talking about how in Utah, it seems to have really emboldened a lot of folks to act in discriminatory ways or even violent ways towards Native people there.
Jackie?
Yes.
I wanted to speak to that, and I'm glad that you segued into that. There is a lot of... racism that was probably latent, and now it is blatant. And one of the things that happened early on in the term is, remember the the outrage there was in Indian country after Donald Trump made his Pocahontas comment when he was at a function that was to honor the Navajo code talkers.
Yes, yeah.
And he had called Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. And so it wasn't just the racism in that statement, but throughout his term here, we've seen a lot of misogyny, a lot of just attacks on women. And so it's kind of, how do you say, encouraged it.
Mm-hmm.
Encouraged it a lot. And so when I go back to the, there's a lot of damage being done during this administration. Again, I have hope in my heart that people are getting educated about these issues, about racism, about misogyny, that they are getting really educated about this and that we can see the pendulum swing in the opposite direction.
And Mark, how do you feel about the whole Trump's sort of trying to delegitimize media coverage using the whole fake news thing? How do you feel as Indian Country Day has to address that, or do they need to? I mean, it does seem like I watched Jake Tapper and he's aggressively, you know, confronting Trump and his. How do you feel? What do you think? What is Indian Country Today's approach going to be?
Well, primarily do our job. I think as long as we keep our focus on getting the stories out. And it's funny because just the other night, on a whim, I watched the movie Game Change about McCain's campaign in 2008. And in that story, it tells about Steve Schmidt, who just left the Republican Party. But Steve Schmidt was the guy that decided to bring in Sarah Palin. And it was a disaster from the beginning. But boy, it really presages everything that's happening today, where these elements of folks just making stuff up rather than basing it on any kind of intellectual discourse has become the norm for the Republican Party. And it really started back then when they brought in Sarah Palin despite the evidence that she wasn't ready for the job.
Wow. That's so... I would, I guess for myself, you know, I definitely, I really wanted to address this because I see this as Trump's administration on all levels, whether you're talking about Zinke at the Department of the Interior. I think many Americans don't realize, but Native Nations, we are not being dealt with the Secretary of State. We are in the interior with the, animals and wildlife and national parks and we have to deal with Zinke in a way that I think most people don't realize how much say he has over our issues with the Bureau of Indian Affairs being in the Department of the Interior each new outrage that happens, it almost feels like you feel numb to it after a while. Like I think there's looking at everything that Scott Pruitt did when he was at the EPA, looking at, you know, everything that, you know, and it seems no matter how many times they get caught doing things, you know, the recent release of information that the Department of Interior ignored in its decision to reduce Bears Ears, you know, the importance of the recreational economy to communities in Utah. How do you, as journalists covering this, you know, in Indian country, how do you sort through it? How are you directing your readers to analyze all of this?
Well, Interior is a huge story. And right now, just this week, there was a story that basically the secretary didn't do what he said he was going to do at Bears Ears and basically lied about the data on why they were doing it. So we just have to keep calling it a town. I really think the elections will clean this out in a lot of ways. And I think there's a reason why there's so many candidates running. And there's kind of an ebb and flow throughout U.S. history where you get in crazy times like this and they're replaced by folks that have a different take. It really, and you almost have to go back to the 1950s and the termination era to get this sort of really antagonistic approach to governing.
Uh-huh. And how about you, Avis? How do you? I mean, you're working directly with with on the reservation with the Standing Rock community. How do you help them as the publisher of the Teton Times? How do you help the readership sort of grapple with all these changes going on under the Trump administration?
Mainly through education, is to print the stories, get them out there, and inform the people. Like Mark said, continue to do our jobs and inform them about issues. As an Indian newspaper, we do do a lot of Indian advocacy. We do it from the Indian perspective. Our stories that we print are from the Native perspective, about sovereignty, about treaties, about water rights. And that's basically what we do. I realize that a lot of people in our rural areas on our reservation don't have access to the mainstream media. And so we do try to educate them about the issues that are hot button issues at this time. Tell them what's going on with gaming. Tell them what's going on, you know, with like the comment about Pocahontas, and tell them about the reorganization of the BIA. Again, with what the tribes feel, there was no consultation. Tell them about like the Bears Ears, the how the Trump administration says it is easing the burdens in environmental review, but it means discarding policy and laws that protect us and the environment. So just informing our people, that's what we got to do, inform them all about the issues and what's going on, and continue to do that.
We haven't even discussed the reorganization of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That seems, I mean, I think a lot of Americans don't realize the role that the Bureau of Indian Affairs plays for Native nations, for all 574 federally recognized tribes. Mark, could you talk a little bit about that a little bit?
Sure. So the Interior Department is going through a massive reorganization, and they want to reorganize the department along watersheds and other boundaries rather than the way they've been doing it through states and regions. And they decided early on to start a BIA reorganization through that same process, but they let it be known that tribes could object and stay out of this reorganization and continue on with what currently exists. But even that's problematic for tribes, because it means tribal councils may have to deal with a Bureau of Indian Affairs office in Aberdeen and a Bureau of Land Management office in Denver. And just having the Interior Department going through such a massive reorganization in such a rapid period, I mean, they're trying to do this like next year, I think raises all sorts of real practical complications.
Yeah, it's not the, often with what this administration is doing, what the Trump administration is doing, it seems like they have already, they claim that they're going to do consultation, but they actually already have in their mind what they're going to do. And, like at Bears Ears, where they just completely, Zinke just completely ignored the input of tribes and thousands of supporters, just to listen to mining companies and their interests. It's worrisome when they're going to undertake, huge change in how the federal government works with tribes. And a lot of the money that comes through the Bureau of Indian Affairs to fund a lot of tribal programs are also at stake.
Jackie,
yes.
Right. I know we're running out of time.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to mention one more thing before we go.
Okay.
We haven't said anything about immigration reform. And again, I mentioned that we speak of these things as Native journalists from the Indian perspective. And one of the things that I was able to talk to a friend of mine a couple weeks ago at the Sundance, and we spoke about how Native people are indigenous to this continent. So a lot of the people that are being flagged as immigrants are indigenous to this continent. And so there's just so much that needs to be discussed, because as the mainstream media is saying, they're talking about, don't be in this country illegally. But if you're indigenous to this continent, you're not in this country illegally.
Yeah, Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's we'll have to do a whole other show on Native perspectives on immigration policy and our relatives from the South who are coming up here seeking, you know, refuge from extreme violence in their own communities, particularly in Honduras. And well, thank you both for being on here. I really appreciate your perspective. Once again, we had Mark Trahant, who is the editor in chief of Indian Country Today. He also has a blog called Trahant Reports and has been a major voice nationally on the issue of the Native vote. And Avis Little Eagle, who was the publisher of the Teton Times, the main paper on the Standing Rock Reservation, and was there covering it as her tribe faced off against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And thank you both. And this is Jacqueline Keeler. I am a Native journalist located here in Portland, Oregon. And you can read about my coverage of Trump with his effects on Indian Country Day in Indian Country in High Country News, Yes Magazine, and also on Medium. And thank you all. And I hope you have a wonderful week.
Take care.
I ain't got a crying time. I'm that way all the time. There's mean things happening in this world. There's mean things happening in this world.
KABU hosts a monthly film series called KABU at the Clinton, hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll screen the film Undocumented on Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. Undocumented is a documentary about a 13-year-old who travels from Colombia to join his parents in America and his life becoming a surgeon. It is a story of struggle, loss, danger, courage, and love. Again, that's a film screening of Undocumented, Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting and the many people who are part of KABU's history.
KABU, I really think, is a good resource.